The following episode may contain inappropriate material. Listener discretion is advised.
You're listening to the PVD Cast with John Orlando.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another installment of the PVD Cast. I am your humble host and your podcast purveyor, John Orlando, and welcome to episode number 471. I hope all is well with you out there, and thank you very much for checking out this edition of the PVD Cast. Well, I'm still feeling a little under the weather. Whatever this thing is, cold or allergy or whatever, it's been getting better, but I've kind of still plateaued off a little bit. And I only mention that because when I recorded this conversation with my guest for this episode, I was still really sick. And so I hope that that doesn't come across in this conversation, because my guest and I had a fantastic time talking both on air and off air. And so without any further ado, I'd like to introduce Wes Easton. He is a filmmaker out of Mount Vernon, Ohio, and he's the man behind Scratch Lens Productions and a new documentary called Shopping for Superman. Now, the basic gist of this documentary is that Wes started to chronicle the disappearance of comic book stores, because for a long time, they were the place to not only get your comic books, but also to hang out, meet new people, learn new things, etc., etc. And with several of them going out of business, Wes was wondering why that is. Is it because of digital comics? Is it because of the Diamond distribution fiasco? Well, we dive into talking about all of those things, including some other possibilities as well. So if you're a comic book fan, you're going to love this episode. There's a fantastic story that Wes shares about meeting Christopher Priest. I'm going to save that for the cast, and I encourage, even if you're not a hardcore comic book fan, give it a listen, because, you know, it's very interesting to see how one or two things, if they go the other way, or if one or two other things happen, then the whole outlook for the comic book industry is radically different. So, with that, though, ladies and gentlemen, I need to talk about a great independent comic book store, my favorite comic book store. And that is, of course, World's Greatest Comics. They're located at 5974 Westerville Road in Westerville, Ohio. And they have tons of comics from every era. The golden, silver, bronze, and modern. They also have graphic novels, collections, toys, comic book supplies, collectibles, hundreds upon hundreds of back issues. So you owe it to yourself to stop by the store, especially if you're in Central Ohio. Again, they're located at 5974 Westerville Road in Westerville, Ohio. But if you're out of town, you can definitely still keep up with what's happening at the store through their website, wgcomics.com, and they're very active on their Facebook page. Just search for @WGComics. All right, with that out of the way, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to throw it to a quick break. And on the other side of the break, you're going to hear my conversation with Wes Easton talking about his film, Shopping for Superman. Ladies and gentlemen, before I introduce my guest, I know I mentioned it in the intro. As of this recording, I am under the weather a little bit, so please excuse the sound of my voice and any type of long gaps of mute, because I'm probably coughing up a lung. But with that being said, all that out of the way, I would love to introduce to you my guest this evening from Scratch Lens Productions and from the documentary Shopping for Superman. Mr. Wes Easton is joining me. Wes, how are you?
I'm doing great, John. I would ask how you are, but you made it quite clear.
Well, you know, I don't know what to say. My immune system is
being weird, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I completely understand. I'm an indoor kid traditionally. So that means I try to avoid people, the outdoors, and somehow I still get sick constantly, and or the allergies, they find me. So I feel your pain.
I gotcha. Well, let's talk a little bit about the summary of the project Shopping for Superman. Can you give us just a brief little synopsis without giving away too much?
Oh, yeah, I'll give it a shot. What I like to tell people is that Shopping for Superman is the origin story of your friendly neighborhood comic book shop. I mean, people, I say our age, we grew up with comic book stores as kind of a given, but you would also find comics kind of out in the world. You know, there was this transitional state before comic book shops just kind of became the norm. But I was very curious when I was a kid, they were going away left and right. I didn't really know what was going on in the industry, you know, but all of my shops that I would frequent just were closing and didn't really have an outlet for that. So that kind of led me to ask, like, what led to that? And then I discovered the backstory of how what's called the direct market, you know, how comic books get from the publisher to the retail comic book shop. It led me to wonder, you know, well, how did that get started? Because it hasn't been around really that long. I mean, comic book shops existed in, you know, places here and there collecting old books, but they weren't really a venue for new comics. You would find like a Superman number, think of a low number, and someone selling it for what was a lot of money back then, like $20. And but you would find all your new books on the spinner rack or at the drugstore, the 7-Eleven, that sort of thing. And as I started to kind of unravel this, I saw just an amazing story. A lot of the characters in there explaining this sort of cutthroat business that came about as all these different direct market distributors came around, where they would sell comics, you know, at cost almost, with a little bit of a markup, cheaper than what you would get it from the traditional magazine distributors that kind of carved up the country. And you were actually able to open a store that focused primarily on comic books as a result.
Well, I'm glad that you talked about the distribution of those comics, because I think, you know, for those that don't know, in 2025, we've been battling, so to speak, over the last couple of years with different distribution companies coming and going. And it has really disrupted the flow of a lot of comic book store owners, correct?
Oh, yeah. And some of the interviews, some of them, little heated language. So it didn't make it into the film because it was also what you're describing. I mean, when DC, let's back up a little bit. Diamond Comics has been for the past, I want to say, 30 years almost, has been the sole, for the most part, sole distributor of comic books to stores. You could still get books from other sellers, but Diamond was more or less the monopoly, the big honcho. So they had an exclusive distribution deal with DC Comics for the longest time, since the 90s. And DC always had the right, or had the ability, to buy Diamond if they so chose. Instead, they decided to start distributing their own books. And as a result, you couldn't get DC Comics from Diamond. You had to order them directly from DC. And that was, you know, we're talking big two, big three comic publishers out there. That was one big pillar that went away. And as a result, I mean, that happened, I want to say, close to the start of the pandemic, or during the pandemic, that change happened. And now we're seeing Diamond filing Chapter 11. Who really knows how that's going to shake out? But we've seen other distributors come along as a result. Penguin Random House has been making a real big show. Lunar, trying to think of the different names. You put me on the spot. I couldn't answer which of the different ones. It's something that I've had to write down as I go. Because like you say, some make a strong showing, some not so much. I mean, the market's really going to decide in the future here.
Well, you know, and I think the other thing that we have to consider too when looking at this topic is we're looking at, you know, the age of Amazon. You know, I mean, I'm as guilty as anybody else. I'm not going to sit here and pretend like I don't order trade paperbacks from from Amazon or collections from Amazon. I do, because they have the business model that makes it affordable for me to do that.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, you're going to order them. They're going to be there in another day or two. You don't have to leave the house, but you're doing a huge disservice to local shops. I mean, at the end of the day, if you want the books, you're going to get them. A lot of people have argued about digital comics versus physical copies, ordering things through online sellers like that. There are ways of ordering through shops to have them delivered to your house. It's probably not going to be there the next day. You're probably going to pay for shipping, but you're also helping to support a shop that way. And something I always recommend to people is if you can avoid Amazon for this at any cost, there's a website called Thrift Books. You can get secondhand books if you're not looking for a new title, you're looking for something older, which is also kind of great. You're going to find, you know, original prints of some of the trade paperbacks, graphic novels, collections. They're all on there, and they're a little cheaper than the full price. Again, you're going to wait a little while to get them, but that's one way of not necessarily supporting Amazon, because their model, and they've always done this, they find a way to sell a product, you know, en masse, but with the lowest price point that you're going to find, and in a lot of ways underselling a lot of shop owners out there that are selling it for full price because they have to, because their margins are so slim. They buy it for X amount of money. They sell it for a little bit of a markup to pay their rent. I'm not going to sit here and say that, you know, that's what's killing the industry entirely, but that is, it's a huge detriment to shop owners. If you have a local comic book store, go. If you're like me, I'm in the middle of nowhere, the nearest comic book shop that has a good selection that I can kind of peruse and not just order books, you know, when I know they're coming out, is about 40 minutes away. And I make it a point to travel to them once, twice a month, and have a pull list so that if it comes in, I know it's going to be in my box when I go. They're going to hand me a stack of like $60 worth of comic books. And that's the way I do it. But yeah, to each his own. I mean, some people just don't have access. And so what else can they do? They're not going to order a book from across the state or, you know, in a different county necessarily, if they can have it shipped directly to their house.
You know, you mentioned something that I also was going to kind of ask you about in regards to, you know, the issues that are going on with these comic book shops. In your humble opinion, what is the big difference between a digital comic and a physical copy of it? Like, do you lean towards one way or the other?
That's a great question. In my humble opinion, I'll try to be humble. The physical copy to me is, I almost brought in some lingo. It's where it's at, man. Like I like a physical book. I mean, I've moved a few times, and every time I move, the movers have these long boxes and they're like, what the hell is in this? And I'm just like, comic books. And they're like, are they worth anything? I'm like, no. A lot of those are 90s books. A lot of those are Buffy the Vampire Slayer comics that I just can't get rid of. Like, I have collections of stuff that it means a lot to me. And
no, I get you.
It exists in a physical state. And a crazy thing that I can do, and I think most people can, you know, it's almost like having a vinyl record collection. I can open this box and I can remember for most of them when I bought the book, where I was in my life, and what it means to me. I mean, I don't think a digital comic can do that. There's something about physicality that it means a lot to me from my experience. But that said, I like a digital comic because darker inks and whatnot on a page. I like to read before bed. Some of my favorite artists, they keep it dark, man. And so I need an extra bit of light to be able to see it. Whereas on a, you know, an iPad or a tablet of some kind, I can see so much more of the art. I can zoom in. It's not necessarily how it's meant to be experienced, but I think it adapts well. But when you buy a digital comic, you're buying an experience. And if you're just reading a comic for a story, I don't see any harm in having a digital comic. But in most cases, you're leasing that book. You don't own it. So at any point, and this happened with Comixology as well, a lot of people couldn't access the books that they had bought previously. And they're saying, well, no, I bought this thing. What the heck? You know, you can't take that book out whenever you want necessarily. It's also not something, you know, a lot of us who buy comics, there is that quiet promise about collectivity, you know, and that can get dangerous. You know, some people will buy every variant cover, they'll buy, you know, every number one, every number two, and just put it away, bag it, board it, and stick it in a box. Maybe one day it's worth something. I mean, my Deadpool and Wolverine comic from the 90s was worth $50 at one time, and that felt kind of good. If it were a digital comic, which, you know, you can go into Marvel's library and read every comic that they've published in the past, you can read that story, but you don't have the ability to say, well, hey, this thing I own is now worth X amount of dollars and sell it, buy it, whatever. You know, it's a digital thing that it's not worth anything but the story and the time you put into it.
I will say digital comics, I think, works really, really well for independent creators.
Oh, for sure. I mean, that was one of the great gifts of the direct market and comic book shops, is you suddenly had a place where creatives could make their own book and get it distributed. And now with digital, you have a way of getting your book in front of someone in, you know, a matter of moments. If they say, oh, I want to check out your thing, boom, it's in your inbox, take a look, or, you know, check out this website and give it a look.
One of the things that I saw while doing my research was a quote about, and I'm paraphrasing, comic book shops have had a hand in cultivating cutting edge stories or very provocative stories.
Sure.
Could you give an example of what you mean by that statement?
For sure. I mean, Watchmen is a great example.
Okay.
To quote Jeffrey from Jeffrey's Comics in the documentary, you're looking at a maxi series with swearing, with violence and curse words. You think they're going to sell that at 7-Eleven? Like, that's, you know, it's audiences grow up for any type of media, and comics are no different. And when comic book readers wanted something a little more sophisticated, a little more grown up, they couldn't necessarily find that in a lot of, you know, the grocery store, the newsstand. But comic book shops allowed for stories that grew with their audience. And as a result, you get something like Watchmen. I know Neil Gaiman's not at the top of anyone's favorite list right now, but Sandman. I mean, the impact of Sandman was incredible. You're looking at mature stories, sure, but stories that have changed the game. Frank Miller's Dark Knight, you know, Dark Knight Returns. That's one of those books that, like, changed the game. Any documentary you watch about comics, it's mentioned just because it went from zany Batman to a very serious, a very dark story. Also, I mean, to your point about creators being able to get distribution in new ways, at the time, look at Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. I mean, it's not necessarily a more sophisticated story. It's what, a take on Frank Miller's Daredevil in a way. It's a lot of it is an homage to that. Instead of the hand, it's the Foot Clan, you know, things like that, black and white. And it changed the game for what comics could be in a lot of ways. I mean, it was a phenomenon. And when I met Kevin Eastman, I even told him, you know, my mom wants some of her money back, you know, for all the toys that I got as a kid. Or Jeff Smith, he's here in Columbus. Bone. He was able to, and he's a madman for doing this, but he was able to write, draw, ink, publish, and distribute his own book, which now, I mean, it's one of the best-selling Scholastic Reads of all time. The colorized edition of Bone is just one of those books that you ask people of a certain age, they read Bone, they have Bone, or at least, you know, it was a part of their childhood in some significant way. And that couldn't have been done without comic book shops.
You mentioned Kevin Eastman, but you also spoke to quite a few other legends for the project, correct?
I did. I kind of went far in a field because, I mean, a big part of this documentary, when I thought of it initially, I saw what was out there. There are a few comic book and comic book shop docs. I wasn't really happy with what I saw, and I thought that the thing that was lacking was like a personal touch. Like, I wasn't seeing through the lens of the creative who was making the project. They were trying to tell a very broad story. So I decided I was only going to focus on people that I was very enamored with their work, or if not that, that they had, you know, a huge impact on the direct market, or in comics in general. I even reached out to John Carpenter. I have an official email from John Carpenter telling me to leave him alone. Just it was a kind no. He was just like, I don't want to talk about this. And like, but you like to, you know, get high and read comics and whatever. He's like, yeah, I don't want to talk to you. That's fine. One of my first interviews actually was with Christopher Priest, who he wrote what didn't he write? But Black Panther, he gets credited with a lot. When I met him, he was writing for, I almost said Slade. That sounds right. Deathstroke? Is that?
Yeah, I'm, Slade Wilson. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Deathstroke. Nice. Yeah. So he was being brought back to DC Comics to pick that back up. This is how old the efforts were for this project. And he was like, oh, hey, you know, you can meet me at DC in Burbank and we'll just do an interview there. And I was like, that's like, the ability of someone to meet a stranger on the internet, believe in the project and welcome them in. DC wasn't thrilled with it. In fact, they've sent me a few emails since just about the title, about, you know, because I showed up, I told, I'm going to butcher his name because I've only read it a number of times. Dan Didio. Pretty sure it's Dan Didio.
I think it's Didio. I'm not sure how it is.
I just lost a lot of nerd cred right there. But
well, that's okay, because there's a name that we do call him, you know, among certain circles.
Oh, yeah,
circles,
I'm but, sure. You know, yeah. He was co-publishing. PG, folks. Oh, wow. he was a co-publisher at the time at DC, and I went up to the floor he was on. I literally just walked in. I don't recommend this to anyone, but when you carry camera gear, a lot of times people just let you go wherever you want. So I went to the floor I was supposed to go to. It was made to look like Superman's Fortress of Solitude. It's beautiful crystals, lit crystals everywhere. I go to the young lady at the desk and I'm like, hey, I'm here to interview Christopher Priest. She has no idea what I'm talking about. Asked me to have a seat. I sit down. Then the largest man I have ever seen. He could have been Kingpin. He was wide, bald, and very intimidating. And he comes out and he just says, Dan is not taking interviews today. And I said, okay, I'm here to interview Christopher Priest. And he goes, I don't have you on a list. Have you been recording anything in this space? I said, no. And, you know, I had, but I I wasn't about to hand him anything. And he was like, you need to leave. I said, oh, okay. So I left DC. I texted Christopher, who then told me, stay where you are. He came back and it's the, you know, I've never seen someone kind of throw their weight around so just calmly. But he was like, no, we're going to take over a conference room. This is going to take, what, 40 minutes? I said, yeah. Went into the conference room. They're like, well, you can't. Okay, so there's a lot of Jim Lee art. You can't record that. He's like, it's fine. And had a amazing talk with Christopher. And so a few years back, my hard drive died. I was able to recover a lot of the footage for this film, but I lost that interview. And it's one of the... Yeah, it's a heartbreaker, but there've been a lot of like other great interviews with great people, and some I had so much content I couldn't fit it in, so I'm trying to cut some shorter videos. I'm doing that right now. I've only got I think 4 at the time on our YouTube channel, but just little snippets from other interviews that won't make it into the final film. Dan is one of them. He was at GalaxyCon there in Columbus, and he took time to chat with me, and I told him the story, and I said, your security guy or whoever he was, the largest man I've ever seen, he told me to leave. He said, oh, he's not security, that was our head of marketing. We take him with us, you know, on events because he's head of marketing. That's what he needs, you know, he needs to be there. And people thought he was security as well because he's just so huge. I thought that was great.
Oh my goodness, that's a fantastic story. I was impressed with Derek Robertson. You got a chance to talk to him.
Yeah,
I'm a huge fan of The Boys and Transmetropolitan and those books that he did. So I got to be honest, I was geeked out for that when I read that.
I told him up front that I was going to be geeking out a little bit because Transmet is one of my favorite series of all time. And it's funny because I interviewed him at Golden Apple in Los Angeles, and while we're chatting, what's the guy's name? Oh, James Gunn. He walks in and I can hear his voice. I don't know why Romeo and Juliet wasn't so impactful that I'm going to remember James Gunn's voice, but I hear him and I, out of the corner of my eye, I see him, and Derek's like, you want to turn your camera around and grab him? I was like, no, I'm talking to you. I'm not going to harass a stranger and, you know, interrupt our flow. And he gave me like a little appreciative nod, whatever. He's just such a cool guy. And then when the camera was off, I said, okay, so this is when I'm going to geek out on you. in, I want to say it's Transmet 2 or 3. There's a party scene at Spider's apartment, and it's a two pager. And I'm pretty sure you drew Patton Oswalt and Brian Posehn as party guests. And he goes, yeah. I said, who are the other people in that room? Because one guy kind of looks like Conan O'Brien. I don't really know who I'm looking at. And I've just always been curious who that is. And he goes, you know, this is insane. The original art for those pages is actually owned by the store owner, Ryan. And so he turned to Ryan. He's like, would you bring out those pages for me? And they were framed in like a big spread. And so he walks, I wish I kept rolling. He like walked me through, this is my friend from college. This is my wife's, you know, it was just crazy. Wow. 'Cause I've obsessed over it in a weird way. Like not really, but when I read the comic, I'm just like, these have to be other references on this page. These have to all be Easter eggs.
I think it's criminal that more people don't know about Transmetropolitan. I mean, it's fantastic. It's timely. I mean, the thing that blew my mind was, and I've read up on Warren Ellis. I know he's not very popular either, but he does a lot of research because, like, you think about the technology that was in that book was years ahead of what I mean, instant feeds for news and everything. That was something that was just coming out when that book came out. You know, video phones, just the crazy amount of technology that was in that book just blew my mind.
I'm very surprised no one's tried to adapt it into like a Netflix series or something. Because yeah. I don't know how you would do it. Just it's so heavy and complex and also corny and goofball. And like, it's, I don't know. It spoke to me as a kid. Like that, Preacher, Sandman were like my three tops when I was first getting back into comics. Because when my stores went away, I didn't have a ton of access to ongoing. So you could order them through the mail. And I did that for like Onslaught and all that. And I think for, what was it? Age of Apocalypse. Neither were things that really made me want to sink my teeth into much. And then I had a crush on a comic book shop girl, as one might do. And she was like, well, what are you reading? And I gave her kind of the, you know, mostly Capes and Boots type stuff. And she's like, you're reading Sandman now. And then, so I read all of that. She's like, now you're going to read that. And so as a result, I realized like, I don't actually really dig superhero stories as much, you know, as an adult, but these others are, you know, this is some complex, some really groovy stuff. The art's incredible. You know, you read it, you want to go back and reread it. Like when you were a kid, you know, just make sure you didn't miss anything.
I'm going to interrupt my conversation with Wes for just one moment to talk to you about World's Greatest Comics. They are your one-stop shop for all your comic book-related needs. They've got single issues, graphic novels, collections, toys, collectibles, hundreds upon hundreds of back issues. You name it, they got it. So, you need to check out the store. They're located at 5974 Westerville Road in Westerville, Ohio. Or you can follow them online. WGComics.com is a web address. And they're pretty active on their Facebook page. Just search for @WGComics.
Well, let's talk about, you had a Kickstarter, but it is over and it is fully funded. And so what if people still want to become part of the project? What if they want to still donate? Can they? And if so,
yeah, how? Yeah, you can still donate through the Kickstarter. If you want to lock in a digital copy or a Blu-ray, that's still available. What I'm trying to do is transition out of Kickstarter because they collect a fee and then I pay tax on the fee that they collected. So I'm trying to move to a new system on our website. If you go to shoppingforsuperman.com, we are selling t-shirts. There's, you know, the typical merch, stickers, some iron-on patches. We're going to be adding posters to that. And then because of the festival circuit, I can't release the movie anywhere just yet. Later in the year, I'll be able to make it possible for people to download a digital copy if they want, or there will be a Blu-ray we're producing in May. That's only going to supporters via the Kickstarter. So it's a little limiting right now in terms of that. I mean, the best way to support us right now really is eyeballs, likes, views, sharing. I just dropped a trailer today on all of our socials. Taking a look at that, sending it to people, generating interest and buzz. I mean, when the movie finally comes out, I have high hopes of, if there's no major distributor that picks it up, I was hoping to do something like a tour where we go to a town that has a few shops kind of proximate to a theater, and we can rent out the theater, have the shops show up, sell their wares in the lobby, like a mini con of some kind, but then show the film, and then some of those proceeds would go to the shops themselves, because the whole point of this is really raising awareness for comic book shops. I mean, there's a lot of lapsed readers out there who, you know, I'll get back to it, or, oh man, did I not pick up my pull list, you know, from a year ago? I wonder if that's still sitting around. It's not. But following us on socials, sharing our stuff, and supporting your local comic book shop. I mean, at the end of the day, that's the point of this project. It's not so much to make a movie that all of America is going to celebrate so much. It's really to say, hey, you know, if you've never, the way I designed the film is, if you already know about comics culture, you're going to love the movie. If you don't know anything about comics culture, made it in such a way that I think it translates pretty well. I've had some older folks who know nothing of comic books at all watch it and say, I was entertained, I was engaged, I came away knowing a bit more than I did, and I actually understand why these shops are so important to their communities. You know, what they actually provide more than just comic books. These are community spaces. I mean, one of the things that everyone has told me is that their shop is kind of a safe space from the rest of the world. And that's not just for marginalized peoples, but that exists as well. It's a space, it's the third place. We hear a lot about, you know, you have your work, you have your home, and then you have that third place you go to kind of unwind and forget about the other two places, you know, weighing on you as much. And whether that's playing magic at your local comic book shop, or going in, you know, finding something new to read, talking with a shop owner or another customer. I mean, if people only think of comic book stores the way like the Big Bang Theory or The Simpsons presents them, they're going to feel like, well, you know, it's not a welcoming place. And they've really evolved since the early to mid to late 90s. Like they're places where you will, you know, this will sound silly to some who frequent shops, but they're places you'll find women now. Like you'll find more than just, you know, kind of a plump straight white guy. It's not just a cave or a man-child cave or a boys-only club. It's a place where you can go and actually find people that share your interests. And even if that's just storytelling and art, I mean, you're a good comic book shop is going to put you very quickly into a story that's perfect for you and something that you're going to want to go back to more than just to pick up your, you know, all jokes aside, your Superman or, you know, your typical fare from when you're a kid. Because again, people see this as like a sophomoric or juvenile thing, and comic books and the culture of it has really come a long, long way since the early days.
And I will say that I took a look at the trailer that you put out. You sent me a link to it, and it's a fantastic trailer. It's really well done, ladies and gentlemen. You need to go find it on YouTube. I assume that it's under Shopping for Superman.
Yeah.
Just search for that. It's a really well. I enjoyed the way the look, the cinematography of it, the editing of it. I really enjoyed that. I already sent it to my local comic book shop. I hit the shop owner up and was like, hey, I don't know if you know about this, but here's a link. Check this out. So I suggest if you're listening, you do the same, folks.
And buy a t-shirt. All right, I'm kidding. But yeah, definitely check out the trailer. I hope you enjoy it. Yeah, that trailer happened because I know a guy that knows a guy who's a professional trailer editor. I can take no credit for it other than, you know, watching it and saying, oh my God, this is amazing. This whole film happened because of people like that. Like I've had an incredible team. A lot of them actually, we built like a scale comic book shop. It's a very minimalist set, but the people who helped me do that, shoot it, they are Kenyon College students. Those were some of our production assistants and local Ohioans. We had people who were traveling, just coming back home at the time. And I got an amazing key grip, Jordan. She's out in LA kicking butt. And a few of the people who were working on my film, they couldn't talk about their next project, but it was going to be in Cincinnati and another shoot in Cleveland. And, you know, I can do math. And I was like, oh, so you're working on a documentary called Shopping for Superman, and then you're going to go work on the actual Superman movie. And they're like, I can't say, you know, a lot of things happen in Cincinnati. And I was like, no, they don't. All kidding aside, Cincinnati is a great hub for filmmaking, you know, but the time seemed a little questionable.
It was too convenient, is what you're saying.
Yeah. And the fact that they wouldn't tell me the name of the project, I'm like, well, I mean, we all signed NDAs and we know what's up. I forget what their working title was at the time. I asked them, is this the, you know, the title of the project? And I got a few nods. I'm like, all right, you know, they're confirmed nor denied. I'm certainly not going to go on a podcast and throw you under the bus.
By the way, I'm glad you beat me to the punch, because I was going to ask you, did you build a set? Because that was in one of the clips that I saw, and I was like, wow, like, I just assumed it would be easier to just to go to an actual comic book shop and do all the filming there. But obviously you had to kind of, you know, with scheduling and everything, kind of weave your way around different obstacles. And so that, I assume that's why you built the set, so that you could have a little more flexibility to film.
Oh, absolutely. I talked to a few people about, you know, what would be the cost of renting a comic book store? Because, I mean, it would be fine if we could show up, not interrupt business, but that's not going to happen when you bring in, you know, 20 some odd people and all the equipment, and you need people. Luckily, we didn't use the sound, but if people walking by in the background who don't want to be in the movie, we're not trying to interrupt anyone's business. And the cost of running a comic book shop is higher than one might think. And so, plus there's insurance and there's all those different factors. That shoot was actually 5 days long, thankfully. So I work at Kenyon College currently, and they allowed us to use their soundstage at the Wright Center here in Mount Vernon. And it was a beautiful, open, empty space. We painted the floor black and then bought things piecemeal. I've had a spinner rack for a while because I've been shooting this movie for a couple of years, and so I needed it for some B-roll. So we had that, and then we had to find glass counters, and, you know, folding tables aren't hard to find, but believe it or not, rolling magazine racks are kind of tricky. And then there's the question of, like, well, I own a bunch of geeky stuff. We can fill it with all of my, you know, priceless possessions, and we did to an extent. But then I thought, you know, I don't own the stuff that you find in a comic book store. Comics, mm-hmm. trades, and some toys aside, I don't have Magic the Gathering cards in foil packets. I don't have Funko Pops because, you know, I have self-respect and dignity. I'm kidding. If you love Funko Pops, that's awesome. But I don't have this stuff. And so I reached out to some of the publishers out there, like Distillery, Oni Press, Vault Comics. I reached out to Dark Horse, Viz Media, the big names. A lot of people said no. DC, in fact, coming back to one of their random emails, they sent me a boilerplate rejection and said, not only are we not going to support your movie, make it very clear that we are in no way involved with this movie. We do not authorize this. And you should probably talk to an IP lawyer about that name, which I did do as a result of that email. But I just thought it was funny. Like, not only are we not going to help you, but we're going to, you know, make you look over your shoulder a little bit as a result. But had a comic book, was it BCW that make the bags and boards and some of the boxes?
Oh, yeah, BCW. For, long boxes. Yeah, yeah.
They sent us a haul of stuff. Some of the other distributor or publishers I mentioned, they sent us some stuff. Actually, Diamond, their toy division, they sent us a bunch of, like, really awesome Ninja Turtle, X-Men, Deadpool, like a lot of the figurines you'll see in the movie. Those all came direct from Diamond. So got a lot of help. It wasn't easy to do, but if I had tried to do this in a comic book shop, I don't know if I could have gotten something as awesome as what we got, being able to really control the space. The set's modular, so we were able to bring things in, move things out, and really give it the aesthetic that makes it very special, very unique. So very happy that it wound up going that way.
I just looked at my list of questions and there was one I forgot because it just popped up in my news feed this afternoon when I sat down. You have any opinions or any thoughts on the rumor of Todd McFarlane taking over Diamond?
That would be interesting. That would definitely be an interesting change to things. I don't know how happy I would be that suddenly all of the toys are going to be McFarlane toys. or that there's likely to be suddenly a new superhero named Hockey Man. All kidding aside, I really have no thoughts on that. I mean, this is news to me. One of the drawbacks of making a documentary about the history of comic book shops is you suddenly find yourself ignoring most of the news because it's only sad. Like, we mentioned Diamond and them eventually becoming the monopoly that they do and a good chunk of their reign. But while I'm finishing the movie, I find, you know, the chapter 11 The bit with DC happened while I was editing a couple of years ago, like still trying to get everything finalized. And I realized like I have to keep the perspective very limited, and it can't be a living thing. Otherwise, I can never finish this movie. Yeah. And yeah, so at this point, I'm hoping for the best for Diamond. I mean, every retailer that I've spoken to had good things to say about Diamond. A lot of things they weren't thrilled about how Diamond worked. I mean, that's going to happen with any monopoly. Like anyone who's keeping all those plates spinning, there's not a lot of incentive to change things that aren't really working so great. And at the end of the day, logistics, and I'm not going to get into all the finer points of, you know, Diamond's business model, but I'd be curious to see what Todd can do with it. I mean, just looking at the longevity of his work and, you know, his importance, that would be kind of an awesome transition from artist to artist writer to suddenly managing a very logistics based end of things.
But he's got the money. He can hire people to do that. He can delegate.
Yeah.
He can delegate. He's not going to worry about, oh, did that shipment get to Kansas City? No, he's not. He's not. He's got somebody doing that. He's got, you know, Ed's going to do that. Ed, figure this out for me.
Exactly. Yeah. I own it now. Cool. Skateboards away. Yeah.
Okay. So this question might be a little bit depressing, and I'm sorry for the listeners if I depress you, but I'm going to say that you, Wes, are going to have an upbeat answer for this. What do you see as the future for comics?
I really had to fight the urge to be like, oh, everything's on fire and we're dying. The future of comics in general.
The future of comics in general. What do you think the future holds?
I think the future is bright for comics, honestly. I mean, the focus of the film was about shop specifically because I don't see comics going away anytime soon. I think access to comics is constantly in flux. Jim McLaughlin in the film refers to it at one point as a sine wave, where he's like, things are good, things are bad. It's not always 72 degrees with a nice cool breeze. But that's at the heart of this project is I'm kind of I can be a negative Nelly sometimes. I don't think the comics question is really as significant because it's a medium that or it's an art form rather that kind of transcends medium. You can have comics in any form or fashion. I mean, most of my Instagram feed is, you know, short panels of comics, you know, just a few like three or four pages of them. I do see comics going back, hopefully, to kind of their earlier form, hopefully. I mean, there's been a big call for comics to not be broken down to be sold as the trade paperback. I mean, most of your story arcs are going to be, what, 7 issues, 7 to 10, maybe? Mm-hmm. And so your narrative is going to be drawn out for 7 to 10. Some people will give you, like if you read, I'm going to common name there, Alan Moore, you read some of Alan Moore stuff. Very dense. You're reading one comic for well over 10 minutes if you're not a super fast reader. And even then, there's a lot to kind of absorb in that. Nowadays, some comics kind of like I've burned through, I won't say their names, but I've burned through some writers' work where I'm just like, the hell is that? And I just spent, you know, $4 or $5 on this book and I read it in like 3 minutes. And like, I can definitely go back and enjoy the art. But I'd really like to see more comics that are standalone, that don't need a 7-arc series to tell a story. That being said, I mean, this is also how writers and artists are staying afloat by being able to do that. So I'm hopeful for some of the larger publishers to bring back like one-off stories that I can read a comic book for 20 something pages, maybe a little more. And I don't have to have read however many other books just to know what the heck's going on in this one. So I definitely see that model. I'm hoping that changes, but that model is definitely going to fluctuate a bit. Cause right now I've heard from shop owners that like variant covers were one of the things keeping a lot of artists, you know, paid. And not a lot of them are paid super well, even from, you know, the bigger publishers. So I don't know. I mean, if it's up to me, I would like to not care about variant covers anymore, and I would like stories that I can sit down and enjoy and not say, oh damn, like they're not okay, someone told me to pick up this one book by this guy or this lady, and it's, I need to read X number of books or crossover books. I mean, we don't do that as much as the olden days where, you know, you get your little editor's note and it's like, to find out why Batman's upset right now, read Catwoman number 30. Like, I don't want to read Catwoman. I only wanted to read my Batman, you know. Sorry, that was a little tangential, but that's I don't really know, to be perfectly honest, how things are going to change. I know that when there are fewer comic book shops, the models will change once again. I mean, it's going to be a gradual thing over time, and we're definitely going to see the effects of that.
All right, so just keep an open mind, and again, as you said, for the listeners out there, support your local comic book store, like World's Greatest Comics in Westerville, Ohio, by the way. Just a cheap plug. Oh, don't worry. They'll get some more plugs here in the intro and the outro as well. But anyways, it's a great store. That's all I can say. Anyways, do you have any other projects that you want to do in terms of another documentary or anything? I know you still have a lot of work to do with Shopping for Superman, but do you have any other aspirations to do another film or anything like that?
Oh, absolutely. I never want to make another documentary again. That's not entirely true. If it were funded, I mean, this thing, we were able to cobble together like $100,000 to make it over a number of years. So it's not a lot of money to begin with and stretched pretty thin over time. If I could have something funded, I would actually like to, I've toyed with making this a series where we would visit shops that are in trouble, something like Kitchen Nightmares, where we flip a store. Store that, you know, needs a little love, bring in artists, bring in writers for signings, kind of take a look at their business model, help them in some ways, maybe have some donations from people so they can have original art to sell or old collections. Some of that's a little aspirational because at the end of the day, no one wants to give anything away for sure. But something that's hosted there and bounce around the country, take a look at stores, get them attention out there. I think one of the problems is we think a lot about comic books. When people think about, you know, this documentary, they ask me specifically about the history of comics. And I'm like, I know this is a very niche thing. It's not a very broad topic. I'm not going to talk about Stan Lee. I'm not going to talk about some of the things, you know, you're going to hear about in the media that you know about. This is really about, you know, a foundational thing for your community, for your kids, you know, get them reading, help them with critical thinking in a lot of ways, right from wrong, big topic in a lot of books. I'm doing the tangent thing again. I'd love to see that. I pitched a show just a little while ago called Chef Shack with Shaquille O'Neal and chefs. And the idea being that you can only cook with the ingredients you can get into a basket past Shaq. So, you know, a lot of my writing and stuff that I'm putting out there, I'd love to make some of that. My background's mostly comedy. And so, really looking forward to making something that keeps people laughing in times where they could use a laugh.
I am excited to see this Kitchen Nightmares like comic book tour show, because you obviously are going to have somebody like Gordon Ramsay that's going to, you know.
Oh, man. Yeah.
Tell off this. You bought how many issues of Riptide from Image in 1994? What do you exactly think these would sell? You know?
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, it comes back around. It's like, you mean you threw those away? Why would you throw anything away? Like, finding someone who's charismatic in the comics community, it's possible now. Like, we have people that are public. My dream would be something like, you know, Patton Oswalt, like take him into a store and be like, go nuts. Be you. Yeah, nothing lined up at the moment. This has really taken all of my free time. And anytime I start to think about, well, what do I want to do after this? Another thing involved with this pops up. So there will be eventually a quiet where I can look at the 20 notes that I have about all these other things I've wanted to do and actually kind of focus on them one at a time.
With that, want to run down one more time, Shopping for Superman, go to the website. That's where you can order t-shirts, stickers, all kinds of stuff, including signing up for getting a copy of the movie. Check out the YouTube channel over there at YouTube and check out the trailer. I think you said there's a couple of trailers, correct?
Right now, we only have the one.
You only have one. Okay, you have the one that you sent out earlier. Okay, but check it out. It's really well done. And how about website, social media? Where can folks follow you, Wes, online?
The best, because my wife explained this to me later. I was like, oh, it's clever. It's shop, the number 4, then Soup, S-U-P-E, Doc, D-O-C. And she's like, why don't you just make it Comic Shop Doc? And I was like, well, that, damn it, that would have been the way to go with that. Instead, I tried to be clever. If you search for Shopping for Superman on most of the socials, we're on Instagram, Threads, Blue Sky, Facebook, and YouTube. And that's as much as I want to do. I'm not doing this Mastodon. I don't know what a Substack is. I don't care.
I don't know what Mastodon is. I've never heard of that.
Yeah. Okay. We'll leave it there then. I someone's like, oh, and it's like Discord and you have these different rooms and groups and servers and stuff. I was like, nope, not doing that. I'm 40 years old. I'm not learning that many new things between now and when I die. That's just where I am.
Yeah, well, that I didn't sign up for Blue Sky. I'm like, I'm not doing that. And then I'm getting pressure from a couple of other podcasters I do shows with. They're like, why aren't you in the Discord? Because I don't want to be in the Discord. I don't want to be.
I'm on Discord for gaming. I will, because I play the Helldivers. I play, you know, some other things, and I keep in touch with like four people on Discord because someone's like, oh, you should. I like a Star Trek podcast. They're like, oh, you should sign up for this Star Trek podcast. And I did. And I don't know if you know this about people, but they're awful. And so the comments kept coming. And it was like, so now I'm part of this group that I want to mute. Why did I sign up for this in the first place?
You got duped, dude. You got duped big time.
I'm an easy mark.
It happens to us all. What can you say? Anyways, Wes Easton, thanks again, man, for sitting down and chatting with me. I really do appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, John. I really appreciate it. This was fun.
All right. With that, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to throw it to a quick break. And on the other side of the break, I'll be back to wrap up the episode. Well, there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. My conversation with Wes Easton talking about his new documentary, Shopping for Superman. And I hope you enjoyed this episode, because I certainly did. It's one of those moments in podcasting where you meet somebody and there's that instant connection. Wes and I talked a lot off air about comics and whatnot. So definitely keep tabs on Wes and the project. As you heard, it's probably still 3, 4, 5 months away from being completed. It's a heck of a project and that I really think you should get behind, and definitely check out all the social medias that Wes is on to keep tabs on that film. All right, with that being said, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for me to tell you where you can get in touch with me if you have a question about this episode or any episode for that matter. You can still find me on Twitter. My personal Twitter handle is @PVDMVP. But you can also drop me a line over on the Facebook, Instagram, and Threads accounts. Just look for @PVDcast. And if you want to, you can shoot me an email. JohnOrlando@PVDcast.com is the email address. But maybe you want to let some folks know where they can hear the PVDcast. Well, there's a couple different avenues for that as well. First, PVDcast.com is the online home of yours truly, and probably the best place to get each and every new episode. But of course, this great show is also available through all those major podcasting outlets and apps. All I ask is that if you use one of those apps or outlets, please take a few moments to rate and review. Rating and reviewing helps me out in the algorithm, and it lets the folks know in charge that you are a faithful listener. It would mean a lot to me. All you have to do is give me as many stars as you think I deserve, and also write me up a quick little blurb, you know, something real short and sweet, like, enjoyed the show. Way to go, John. Anything along those lines will be very much appreciated. But there's also a third and final way that you can listen to the PVDcast, and that's through the Facebook page. Every Wednesday night at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, I do a live broadcast of the week's episode. So there you go, three easy ways to hear this show. PVDcast.com, through your favorite outlet or app, and of course, through the Facebook page on Wednesday nights, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. All right, with that being said, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to get on out of here. I want to thank you once again for checking out the episode, and I will chat at each and every one of you later. Stay righteous, stay independent, and stay safe and healthy.
following has been a presentation of John Orlando Enterprises, LLC, copyright 2025.